Sorry, does this mean we're starting?
Well, I guess we are.
Okay, right.
Well, all right.
We'll start with the date, which is the 14th of January, 2019.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Patrick Crozier. You are Brian Micklethwaite. Mm-hmm. We are going to talk about history. It's a bit more specific than that, aren't we?
History, we share a common fascination with it. We love it. We read it. Why? What are we getting from that?
Why? Right. Yes, what are we... I mean, well, I think the great thing about history is it gives you an opportunity to test your theories.
Mm.
I mean, if you are a communist, you can, and are willing to test the theory of communism, you can look at examples of communism.
Well, that leads directly to one of the things we have in common besides our enthusiasm for history is that we're both libertarians, sort of. I mean, the nuances are no doubt a bit complicated as we get older, but that's what we are. And as libertarians, we are participants in team sport history involving such things as what a terrible thing communism was.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons you study and read about communism is to keep the memory of it alive, because the generation seems to be growing up that is being taught that there's nothing to see here, which is absolutely catastrophic, potentially.
Yes, that's pretty frightening stuff.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, that was it reached a peak when, I remember Finlay Dunnocky, if that's how you say his name, did a posting on Samizdat.org about this historian who'd said, the Cold War is now over. We don't need to think about it anymore. What historian, with their brain on the right way, says something like that? You know, Napoleon's done. We don't need to think about Napoleon. It's 1840, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a crass remark is that? And yet they were saying it and in a context where that seemed normal. But of course, it's abnormally stupid. Another example of an historical debate you and I are both part of, I suppose, as libertarians, is the whole question of the Industrial Revolution. How much good did it do? We say a lot.
Yeah.
How much did it depend upon bad things like imperialism and slavery? How much did the money amassed by bad people in the past make the Industrial Revolution possible? Therefore, is it tainted by its past in the same sort of way that people say America's tainted by the fact that they stole the whole place from Red Indians or Native Americans, as they're now called?
I think we should point out to anyone who's listening to this, we sort of agreed in advance that we were not going to actually discuss the issues as such.
No.
And that this is no, it's I really mean, tempting, by
what,
the way.
Well, what strikes me about both of our interests is that you are obsessed with something that is neither of the things I've just said, and so am I. Well, I'm obsessed with the big picture, I think. I love grand
theory. Sorry, you say I'm obsessed with things
well,
that aren't
you're,
part of the...
you focus in on the First World War. Now,
yes.
It could well be that that was a catastrophe for liberalism, libertarianism, any version beginning with LIB of how the world should be. But there's a lot more to your interest in that matter than just that, isn't there?
There's the question is... Was it right to go to war?
Mm-hmm.
That's one question. Or for the British to go to war? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it was right for the Germans to go to war. How was it fought? Was it? Is the narrative that you hear correct, that it was all idiot generals and brave soldiers? Or is the truth different?
Mm.
And that's my the question I suppose one of the things is I am very suspicious of narratives that I hear in the modern day.
Mm.
And when I hear something again and again and again, I get very suspicious. Is it true? We were told that, I was told many years ago, what was it, that, the Ulster Protestants were responsible for all the problems in Northern Ireland.
Mm.
Now, the fact that I sort of am an Ulster Protestant, even if I don't sound like one, makes me deeply suspicious.
Mm.
So it was worth looking into that.
Mm. I mean, that leads on to another observation about what history does for people generally, and one of the things it does is keep alive tribal spats, doesn't it?
Yes.
By remembering all the bad things the other bastards have done in the past.
Yeah.
Often going back centuries.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Northern Ireland. I mean, very quickly you'll get words like Drogheda and Porter Down and 1641 and Cromwell. All these things will come up. Precisely for that, to prove the other side are complete bastards and we don't trust them. Well, yeah.
Maybe some truth in that.
Yes.
but the point is, that's one of the things that history keeps history alive. isn't it? It's the sense that there are there's unfinished business, so to speak.
Oh golly! I mean, I was rather hoping that there are better uses of history.
I don't want to accuse you of being nothing but an Ulster Protestant. That's not my purpose here. I'm just using your particular example of Ulster Protestantism and the narrative of it as an example of something that happens all over the world.
Yeah.
I mean, same thing with the English and the French, and you know, and the Chinese and the Japanese. I'm sure that one will keep running for a long time. What other thing? Go back to the First World War. That your fascination with it. I confess, I was thinking about this last night. I was watching a TV show about three German submarines, all of which had been sunk by mines off the northwest coast of Cornwall at the end of the Second World War. What had happened was the Brits had put some mines in a cunning, vicious place, calculated to sink U-boats, deep under a convoy route. So the convoy was safe. They were confident about that.
Right.
But the submarines, who had been in the habit of lurking underneath the convoy, suddenly found themselves mined.
Oh.
And three of them got the chop. And there is something...
So is this after or before the armistice?
Before.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah.
Just before. The Second World War, the end of the Second World War. And Second World War.
Right.
I do confess a certain grisly fascination with death. That's part of my motive. You know?
Do you, like I, sort of put yourself in the position of people who have to face this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not a lot of fun, is it?
No. But what are we doing? I mean, it's the same with horror films. I cannot stand horror films. I find them horrifying.
Yes.
But people like them. And I think it's something to do with testing yourself against reality at its nastiest in a kind of pretend way. Sort of steeling yourself for the worst. Which sooner or later comes to us all, doesn't it? And for me, it's getting closer than I would like, you know.
Goodness, yes.
And I do think contemplating death... I mean, another one which I remember reading about was the French nobility at Agincourt, who just... the people behind them charged forwards. They were stuck in the middle, and they just got piled up in a heap of metal.
Mm.
And the Brits were just able to wander around, stabbing them, just open up the lid on their faces, bang.
Yeah.
What would it have been? What the hell would they have been thinking in those last few moments?
Well, it's one of the things I'm fascinated by how people were prepared to put themselves in the line of fire.
Mm.
I mean, certainly the beginning of the First World War.
What we're asking really is, what kind of species are we? That's the question. What is being a human being? What are we made of? What are we like? That's part of it, isn't it?
Well, can I come back? Can we come back to that? Because yeah. I was just saying that my feeling was that the society was different. It was run on in different ways. The willingness of the well-heeled to sign up and get themselves killed, or I suppose they wanted to get killed.
Yes.
I find extraordinary.
Yes.
When I look at what we call the elite today, do I think any of them are prepared to don a uniform?
Well, of course,
and
this
get
argument, this is exactly the argument that happened in the 30s when it seemed that the elite had turned their backs on all this. But famously, they pitched in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Did their bit, all of them.
Mm. In fact, they're very good at it.
Mm. And I think the same of my contemporaries and my youngers. I think that if a major war, which made sense, was explained and really was existential in the way that some stupid nonsense in the Middle East now isn't, I think people would die for that country by the thousand, by the hundred thousand. I think they've got all that it takes to do that.
You think?
Yes.
You think? I wish I was so sure.
I think it's...
I
think that's the kind of animal we are.
Mm, that was your point. We are actually prepared
to
do this.
We're genetically ready to do this stuff. We're as good as we can be and as bad as we have to be and as self-sacrificial as we have to be. And it's our ability to impose the consequences of our higher brain and its thoughts on our instincts to force ourselves to stand in a thin red line or crouch in a trench or drive an aeroplane over enemy territory and take photographs, whatever it is we're doing.
Isn't what you're saying something of a Western thing? Dare I say it?
No, well, dare say it, by all means. Who cares what we say? But no, I don't think it's only a Western thing. I think it's everyone.
No. I think it was you who was, and we're perhaps going off topic. We'll see how we say what you're going to say. I think it was you were talking about the way that in some armies they can collapse very quickly.
I think training is necessary for this to happen, don't you?
I thought you were talking.
You have
about,
to
I
mean, be.
I mean, maybe you didn't recognise what you were saying.
The deal that a soldier in an elite regiment makes is: I'm prepared to stand fast and do my bit, provided the people on either side of me are prepared to do the same. And training establishes that, doesn't it? You all become confident because you've experienced it in training, the nearest thing you can. Everybody obeying orders and doing their thing.
And the esprit de corps yes. that comes from that, mm. that's certainly true. Mm. Well, I know about elite regiments, I certainly wasn't in one.
Well, I think that's probably part of what we want to learn, what it's like, what is an alpha male? What would it be like to be one? I'm certainly not one myself. And certainly not. I consider myself further down the Greek alphabet than you in this matter.
I think we're very... Well, let's not...
I'm not trying to argue. I'm just trying to express a feeling, which is part of what this conversation's for. It's to express why we feel the desire to read history. And I never thought of it. But yes, I want to know what it's like to be Henry V or Edward III, who was a sort of great marshal, Victor Cressy.
Do you feel you can get into their heads?
A bit, yes. Yes.
My sense is that, well, there are two senses. One, in which that there's actually things that we have that they have missing, I think in many cases. And things that they have that we have missing. I don't think they're as honest. I don't think there's a great deal of self-doubt going around. The other thing it seems...
Sorry, say it again. They weren't so honest.
So honest.
And they were much more certain of their rightness.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No questioning themselves. Mm. The other thing is, and this is, we're doing what we promised not to do, which was to talk about specific historical events, is that they are shaped by the situation they are in. It's you try to find a nice medieval king.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you, and I was thinking about this before you got here. I'll tell you a nice medieval king, Edward II. He was...
Oh, that's interesting. I was going to give you Henry VI. But well, anyway...
Same thing. Same idea.
Yeah, well, look what... They both
Henry the... Was it Henry the Third? He was another of these Henry VI characters who spent his time building monasteries and having stained glass windows.
But he lasted 50 years.
Yeah, I know. I know, remarkable. Edward II was more interested in things like the rural crafts.
Right, yes.
And that, the aristocracy couldn't be doing with that. I mean, this bloody man who's supposed to be the King of England would arrive at his court and give them lectures on how to thatch a house. I'm sure that's what, something like that is what happened. The man took peace hundreds of years too soon. He took it seriously as a worthy occupation for a grown man to be obsessed with. In the same sort of way that people are now obsessed with, I don't know, how to make the perfect ball bearing or something.
But you feel as that there's this grim inevitability about this situation being created. It doesn't matter how nice you are, the people around you are going to force you into a certain...
Well, we would, I think, if the modern sort of coffee bar hipster looked at Edward II, he'd see a kindred spirit. But at the time, he was just a wimp who was just walking away from his obligations.
Hipsters, eh?
Well, to me, that illustrates a very big point. It's a trivial anecdote, but the big point that the world's got more peaceful, you know?
Yes.
More creative, more concerned with how houses are built and less concerned with how grenades are manufactured.
Is that true? Is that true?
It is for the time.
This is going back to... You know what we're talking about testing your ideas. Mm. Certainly, from a British point of view, 1815 to 1914, a few wars in between, mostly a long way away.
1945 to now.
Yeah,
that's an amazingly long time for an entire population never to be seriously.
Yeah,
I mean, plenty of expeditions abroad done by a very professional, rather small army. Yeah. That, plenty of that, the Falklands campaign, goodness knows, mm-hmm. but nothing hitting home. No, the nearest thing would be something like the IRA.
But is there a difference here? Because the 19th century peace, well, I was actually going to say the Cold War peace, and notice the use of the word war,
mm-hmm.
Was, I assume, down to nuclear weapons.
I've always thought that.
But what was the 19th century peace down to?
Well, I think the Napoleonic Wars were pretty terrible for the winners, weren't they?
Certainly, Britain had a tough really, 15 really years
brutal
after that.
Time for the people of Britain, and at a time when what the people of Britain were experiencing was starting to count and matter in politics,
mm-hmm.
In a way it hadn't in the past. Yes, a determination to keep the peace.
But I suspect.
But the Crimean War was pretty scary.
I think I'm talking Kondratiev waves here, in that it was interesting that the 2008 collapse occurred when there was no one around who remembered 29.
I agree.
And I suspect what you were saying earlier about people thinking that communism coming back is because, well, okay, communism is only 30 years ago, it's collapsed, but maybe...
The horrors were... more like 70 years ago.
Yeah,
the real brutalities.
The Stalinist stuff.
Yeah, but yes, maybe. I agree. I mean, I remember we talked about the run-up to the First World War, including some quite disturbing economic trends in about 1900, 1910. It wasn't the Edwardian idyll that is often sold as the pre-1914 story. There were lots of scary things going on with prices and costs of things.
Well, I would say it's very slightly scary. Yeah.
But
anyway, yeah.
But scary, but unfamiliar.
Yes.
Is the point.
Yeah.
It only takes a bit. If you've lived for 70 years with absolutely stable prices, 2% inflation.
I mean, let me put it like this. Yes, you occasionally get a sort of, 10-line article in the Times from that period talking about the advance in prices, as they put it. But you get far longer articles far more frequently about Ireland. About Germany,
yes.
About women's suffrage. So,
well, I think those things are... I do believe inflation has a profound effect on...
Yeah.
And I think the sort of economic conditions we've lived through for the last 10 years, since 2008, have a profound effect and have had profound effects.
Mm-hmm.
I think Trump, Brexit, and now what's going on in France, none of that happens. If you've got a ruling class that are doing okay... You said it. You said something about how there's a kind of deal going on between the governed and the government.
Oh, yes, I did, yes.
And the deal's been broken in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
These people are living very nicely, thank you.
Explain what the deal is. Yes, the deal is you, the elite, you can have your environmentalism, you can have your multi-culti stuff.
You can have mansions and the good life. You can have all your stupid opinions, but we've got to be doing okay.
Yes, yes.
And making headway.
Yes.
Feeling that our grandchildren are going to have nicer houses than we do.
Yes.
That sort of feeling.
Yeah.
And that's gone.
That, yeah, the deal's
for lots
broken.
Of people, that has gone.
Yeah.
And that has consequences, even if you ask them to explain it as a sort of argument between Keynesians and neoclassicists, they'd say, what the hell are you talking about?
Yes, indeed.
You know?
No, indeed. And and they wouldn't necessarily express it in terms of, well, my children are going to have worse lives than I have.
No, they might not even have put it into words so much as just, fuck this, that's about all some
and
people...
fuck you.
Yes,
well.
Exactly. Yes.
I
mean, if you're making...
Going off topic here, I mean, I'm amazed at the arrogance of the elites here. I feel quite a lot of them are going to end up swinging from lampposts if they carry on the way they are.
If they do, yes.
Yeah. And I think they are completely blind to it. It's extraordinary.
I don't think they are completely blind to it, actually. I think that the current Brexit argument raging in the British political circles right now, which is, are we going to do a crap deal, no deal, or what? Or are we going to go begging back and join again?
Yes.
I think one of the underlying facts is that a lot of MPs are well aware that if they simply go back to the EU and beg to be back in it again, they will be sitting on a minefield. I really do think they understand that. I think unless you see that fear of... lots of MPs regret the result of the referendum, but a great many of them believe even more strongly, we've got to do that. We've got to have Brexit. in a recognisable form that the punters who voted for it are not going to say, well, this is a bucket of crap. I think they understand that. I think the British elite do. Actually, this is one of the reasons why I think the British elite, for all its horrible faults, is an improvement on your typical continental elite, and especially the French elite. The French elite, it seems to me, their besetting sin, and also German elites, is that they explain everything so logically that they end up unable to understand that there's somebody at the wrong end of things who's just sitting there going, fuck this for a game of soldiers, and spitting in the street, you know. It's illogical, it's irrational, it's emotional, it's silly, deplorable.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that brings us back to our topic. I thought we were going to go sailing off, but actually that's exactly why history and the study of history is so interesting, because it gives you real world. And this goes back to a lecture that a chap we both know, Detlef Schlichter, gave to one of the libertarian alliances that exists now. We both are great admirers of Detlef Schlichter, but he was making a lecture based on the idea that philosophy cannot be falsified by anything that happens in the real world. And I tell you, I hate that argument so much. It really disturbs me.
Yes.
And because it... I love the question, what would change your mind? I think that's a really... I don't ask it of myself as often as I should.
One thing I know that would change my mind is having a sword at my throat. That changes my mind about whatever it is the bloke with the sword is saying. That does it. And what you're talking about is an elite staring at that. Well, that'll change their minds.
Well, I hope so. I'm not as optimistic as you, but we can talk about that later.
Pathological optimist.
I would add something that Christian Michel, I think it's Christian Michel, it's another London libertarian, for those who don't know, once said, Christian is French, he says that major change in France never comes to the democratic process and only comes through rioting and disturbances. Which, you know, you think, Christian, you must imagine, I mean, France has this long-standing democracy, and you think, oh, hang about.
They have quite a lot of republics piling up. You get the feeling another one's coming.
Well, how this one's going to end up, you don't know. But it's persistent. That's interesting. We're talking about the Gilets Jaunes. In case that whole movement gets completely forgotten in 6 months' time, we're talking about them. They are clearly very, very angry. What I find interesting is it seems to be incoherent.
Well, I think the whole coherence of what they might be saying has been completely colonised by their enemies. The French elite are nothing if not super well educated. I mean, they are a meritocracy of people who've been to posh higher education places, much more so than in Britain.
Yes.
In Britain, there are far more oiks trolling around London, bossing people around, you know.
Yeah.
They're far more social rubbish, you know.
Well, what we're saying is that more people go to Oxford and Cambridge than go to the École Nationale de
Administration. No, fewer people. Well, the proportion... The elite in Britain contains many more deplorables than the French elite. That's the sense. That's what I sense. I mean, there were, a man like Farage. Going back, did you watch the Brexit...
No, I didn't. Cause
well,
it's,
in
it's
that,
Remainer
in
propaganda.
That, Farage and his mate Aaron Banks were both presented as football hooligans, you know. And my feeling is, yeah, and that's kind of rather good, you know. The fact that this tendency—I mean, I don't think it's true of Farage at all, and I know nothing about Aaron Banks except how he was shown in this show. But the fact that you've got a couple of oiks changing the course of British history strikes me as no bad thing. I think of that as a rather British point of view, and I think of the French point of view as, but what is the intelligence of this, you know?
What's the logic or something?
What is the argument for this?
Have oiks? Well, I mean, one 19th century oik, of course, was George Stevenson, to the best of my knowledge. Changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
Who
learnt to read and write while his son was learning to read and write.
Arkwright, I can't remember what he did. Cloth,
spinning jenny, was spinning it? Jenny, one of those things. Yeah.
I'm not sure he invented something, but he created a huge factory.
Well, that, you're never sure who invented what in these yeah, things. Yes. It's one of the things you learn from studying the history of the Industrial Revolution is that there are inventions are ready to be invented, and then five people rush to the tape, and one of them wins, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Often because he's a bastard and better at patenting.
That's something that you learn is that it's not just coming up with the idea.
No.
A little word for myself. To the best of my knowledge, I am the inventor of those little political maps you get where every constituency is the same size.
Mm.
I believe I'm the first one to have done one for Britain, and now in every election that comes by.
And yet, inexplicably, these are not called Crozier maps.
They're not called Crozier maps. No, indeed. Well, I mean, I accept that. I didn't.
Well, one day I may encounter a young historian who has adopted my opinion that atom bombs and hydrogen bombs have not just made a difference, but they made all the difference. They have transformed the whole of humanity more than anything has ever done before or ever will again, and makes a career out of it without once mentioning that he first heard of this at some talk I gave. You know, it's possible, I can imagine. But
I must admit, I thought that was true
quite a long time. Yeah, I know. But this fellow got it from me, see, that's the point. Changing the subject somewhat and going back to this business of grand theories of history, I've already rambled on about the grand theory of weaponry, that atomic weapons, atomic weapons and hydrogen bombs all made all the difference to our world. And it's possible to, you can say similar things about the sword and gunpowder. I mean, I once put this to a historian of ancient history, who said actually the biggest single advance in the ability of humans to slaughter one another was not the atomic bomb, it was the sword. That made it possible to industrialise the killing of people in a way that had never happened before, and it's the biggest single advance in slaughter there's ever been. That was what he said. Clearly it was a big, big thing.
Mm.
And gunpowder was pretty big as well. That's a grand theory. But another grand theory, which, I mean, I recently, you mentioned Christian Michel, I gave a talk at his house on the 6th of this month, just over a week ago, on the idea of history as a succession of epochs whose nature is determined by the means of communication and information storage, and how that has changed over the centuries, famously printing, and the other big date I picked on was the development of the telegraph, the electric telegraph.
Yeah.
I love grand theories. Another one is my man Immanuel Todd, who talks in terms of just simply literacy, one of the stories associated with the printing press. The difference between...
Well, there's no point in being literate if there's nothing to read. So
quite.
Printing press is essential to that.
And a printing press certainly makes it easier to learn how to read, in that you can also buy a textbook for all this stuff.
So are we advancing the theory that
history is
determined by technology?
Well, no. What I'm doing is saying I like grand theories.
That's right. What
I'm saying. Right. I like big, simple, oversimplified schemes which enable you to make sense of it all. As Christian said in his introduction to my talk, you don't want history to be just one damn thing after another. And By the way,
I looked up that quote.
Yeah.
It came from, I think, Arnold Toynbee, and he was joking.
Well, whether he was joking or not, he's put his finger on a deeply held feeling. He said,
Do people really think that?
No, they don't want it to be like that. They want some way of knowing which bits of history matter and which bits matter rather less. They want to find a way of deciding which books to read in the first place, which questions to worry away at, and which ones to just say, oh, well, who cares?
Hmm. Is it? I mean, isn't it? If you believe that it's just one damn thing after another, then it sort of destroys the idea of grand theories, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's the opposite of grand theory. Right, okay. That's the point. And for me, I was thinking that the best metaphor I can offer to explain my interest in history is of the puzzle, and I mean literally a puzzle, one of those things with little bendy shapes that you put together to make a picture. And when you do a puzzle, there are two things. One is you scrutinize the individual pieces of the puzzle, like the anecdotes we were swapping earlier. The one about Edward II being more interested in peace than war is, to me, that's a classic little piece And then there's the big grand theories, which are, we're starting to realise that this part of the puzzle has a big bit of blue sky, or it has a railway locomotive, or it has some clouds, or a carpet, or something. And that enables us to say that this particular piece is part of that particular bit of the story. So we can guess that, that if we see a bit of the puzzle which has some bright blue on it, that's probably the sky. And so we can put it in all the other ones that seem to be the sky and then put them together, and eventually it all fits together. And I think, to me, there is a definite puzzle-solving thing. Again, it goes back to what humans are. I think we're...
Although the thing about this is you've got to watch out for the piece that doesn't seem to fit.
Oh, yes.
And then you realise you're actually working on a completely different puzzle.
Yeah.
If you're honest, if you're honest enough to do that.
But that can happen with real puzzles. I think big, complicated ones are like that.
Anyway. Yes, we were talking about history and why we're interested in history, and we were talking about grand theories of history. And I think both of us like the idea that...
It makes some sense. It's going somewhere. All right, maybe not if you really scrutinise it, you can prove it. Progress is a bit of an illusion. But if you accept a definition of progress, like people living longer, being more comfortable, killing each other less, that's not a bad definition of progress. No. Well, by that standard, humanity is progressing. Good.
Yeah, seems to be. I mean, the test of a theory, it seems to me, is what predictions we can make. If we have a grand theory of history, what predictions can we make in, say,
I think that brings us to another point of studying history, which is that despite all the impossibilities and pitfalls of it, we're trying to see what's going to happen next.
Mm.
By getting a sense of the sort of things that have happened in the past and giving us a clue. I mean, I was doing that with Brexit. I was saying, I think the British are going to get their Brexit. It may be a mess, but they're going to get it because they voted for it. That's going to count for something. That's because the British political system, and it's been like this for centuries, is more open to inputs from people who can't explain themselves very well.
That's interesting. I was going to say, I think
it's one of the fundamental rules of debate not to confuse the quality of your opponent's ability to express his argument with the quality of his argument. Do you see what I mean? When you say to somebody, well, you're just talking nonsense, what kind of nonsense are you accusing him of talking? Are you saying he's got his facts wrong, he's being illogical, or are you merely saying he hasn't said it very well? If the latter, then do what Popper said. Try to understand his point of view by actually expressing it better. Try to understand what he's thinking. And I think the British are pretty good at that compared to other elites, French elites especially. That's my... Maybe this is just me fighting the old Anglo-French thing again, explaining why the fact that, I don't know, the French language got replaced by the English, another story that fascinates me, it was a good thing. You know, God was making the right decision there, you know, to get rid of the French language.
The thing is we're assuming that Britain is... Britain in the future is going to be much like Britain in the past. That those sort of attitudes. I mean, you have a sort of expressive grand theory about the British, perhaps English view of freedom, and that goes back an awfully long way. Mm-hmm. You know, to the mists of time.
Yeah, associated with Immanuel Todd and all that, the absolute nuclear family and whatnot. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say it was there was a chap who wrote a book. I can't remember the guy's name.
MacFarlane.
Yeah, The Origins of English Freedom.
That's the one.
Right, okay. I ought to put a link up to it. I promise nothing, but if I'm doing my job properly, I will do that. But he wasn't talking about family structures.
He was talking about family relationships. So, for example, the tendency of young men to defy their parents when they chose who they were going to marry. That sort of thing.
Oh.
And bugger off... live somewhere else.
This goes back to the Anglo-Saxons.
This goes way back. Well, MacFarlane chased this back, and he said it's before my time. That was his conclusion.
Well, before his time.
Yeah, before his time as a historian.
Right.
Because it's
he was an Anglo-Saxon historian. Is that?
Well, he was. Yes. What he wrote his book backwards. He started by saying, "Here's these English being unruly and behaving like football hooligans. When did this start? It goes back to the 19th century. Well, they're still doing it here. Still doing it. And he ends up by saying, I haven't found it.
That's remarkable.
I haven't found the origins of this.
I'm reading Tommy Robinson's book at the moment.
Oh, he's classic.
Wow. I'm amazed. But I can't think of any similar... I can't name any similar Tommy Robinsons in the past. Well, I suppose I did. I mentioned George Stevenson, but not in terms of being politicians. I suppose he's not a party politician, but he's a...
Well, I'm sure... we've already...
I mean, maybe some of these people like John Lilburn...
Can I turn that round and make our ignorance of these oiks in the past into a illustration of what we love about history? We've now got ourselves another question to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any lower-class...
Yes.
Boozing football hooligans in the equivalent of the cabinet in the past. My surmise is, yes, we'll find quite a few if we go looking for them.
Well, I was watching this Canadian documentary about their Minister of Defence of the outbreak of the First World War, a chap called Sam Hughes, who really does sound like a bit of a football hooligan.
Mm.
So, possibly. I mean, you know, what's the difference between a well-educated psychopath and a football hooligan? Not much.
Mm.
Mm. They just...
A deplorable.
Yeah, a deplorable.
Tommy Robinson's fairly deplorable, so we're told, in that his borrowing history seems to be a bit of a mess. I don't care. I mean, I think he's saying true things that people in posh houses have bloody well got to be told. And I say, well done him.
He is the little boy who's saying the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah, he is.
That's what he is.
That's exactly
and
right.
And they hate it.
Yes.
They really hate it.
Yeah, I'm not saying the British like all this. I'm just saying there's something about this country which says they have to put up with it.
Interesting.
I think it's partly the anti-intellectualism of the upper class. The suspicion of logic and argument and cleverness.
Well, you know the upper class better than I would, so is that true?
Well, I have ancestors who... Yes, I think so. I think the military side of my family, which is on my father's side more, are very very well aware of the fact that explaining in absolute minute detail with impeccable logic why you're cleverer than one of your crew is a good way to get hit with an oar. You know, don't do this to people.
Yeah.
Don't behave like that. And anyway, you could very well be wrong. I mean, there's a particular kind of cleverness that consists of explaining why the stupid things you think are not stupid, isn't there? I mean, some of the things communists say about communism are very clever. They're utterly ridiculous and contemptible, but they're very clever.
Yes. I mean, I was sort of going to say that it's a good idea to have clever people at the top of the army. Let's put it like that.
Yes, yes.
And you do
they have their place.
Yeah.
Definitely. I agree. Mm. You don't want thugs being generals and not having any...
Well, unfortunately, you want a bit of both, actually.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. No, you do. Yeah.
And that is, it's a rare combination because the two tend to be antagonistic. So,
The First World War, I want to go back to that because it's your big specialist subject, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it... I mean, I think, to me, the puzzle is everything. That's what I'm interested in. Is the First World War for you a kind of area of specialism and you want to understand it completely? Is that what's going on?
No. I'm not... I mean, I was talking to some First World War historians a few weeks ago, and they're all about, oh, well, I'm studying this particular regiment and what it did in the war, and I'm studying, you know, what happened to people who were invalided out of the army in northern Kent. And no, I don't. I want to understand it from the higher point of view, the top level. You know, as I was saying earlier, was it right to go to war for Britain? How was it fought? I suppose there's one element, as we were talking about earlier, how would I have behaved? How would I have coped? Answer, I don't know. In that respect, the only person I can look to is my own great-grandfather. I look at his experiences and what he did for those sorts of answers.
Unlike you, I don't have any ancestors with stories about the First World War. If I had ancestors who'd fought in the First World War, I don't know about it. Whereas... Wow. I've got a couple of uncles who were in the thick of the Second World War. Three, actually. One of them got killed right early on in what would have been his naval career. which is a very good corrective to what the other two did. They got lots of medals and survived. He got shot in a target
practice. Maybe it isn't helpful because, as you were saying earlier, you probably don't put yourself down as a great military hero. So
definitely not.
No.
But I think another point, what was great-grandpa doing is a question a lot of us have.
Yeah.
I certainly am fascinated by the Second World War, partly for that reason. You know, what was my dad doing? He was mixed up in some way, I can't clarify, with Ultra and all that in some junior and
Blimey.
Capacity.
Blimey.
My guess is he was summarising Ultra Decrypts, a job like that. He wasn't part of the actual decryption operation, but he certainly knew about it before most people did. I'm sure of that. Mm. He was reading books about it.
I mean, when we say things like that, that he was, you know, doing something with decryption, do you think, like I think, my instant thoughts are things like the hours that he's working, the fatigue, the rubbish food, the stress.
Yes.
That's the sort of thing.
In my case, my father talked from time to time, like once a decade, about the guilt.
That he's felt. Here in a comfortable office
and
not get, you know, not get himself killed.
Yeah. He missed the First World War because he was just too young, and he missed the Second World War as a combatant because he was just too old. And it made him feel very... I think he felt like less of a man.
Well, I kind of understand that.
Mm, so do I.
Because I've never had to fight a war.
I feel like less of a man for the same reason, perhaps. You know, never had to do this kind of thing. Never come anywhere near it. I don't feel so guilty because it's the same as everybody's enjoyed in this country.
Yeah.
Unless they chose to go off and fight, which is a different thing altogether. But so why the First World War? The big questions about it. But surely not getting bogged down in minute and irrelevant detail is just another way of saying you want to understand the whole thing.
Yeah.
Spending all your time on one regiment denies you the big picture, but you want the big picture of the First World War, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, and that I'm prepared to work pretty hard to find.
Mm.
I'll blow my own trumpet for a minute. I came up with a theory to explain the origins of the First World War, which actually explains a lot more than that, and that's the what I call the Crozier Monarchy theory.
To me, the real home run, as the Americans would say, of that theory is that you realise things could have been worse. That was fascinating. I do anyone listening to this, I do recommend the conversation we had about the first of this little set of podcasts we've done, which was my favourite, I think, so far. Partly because it was on your territory. What other things to be said about history? I want to talk about the escapism idea. I mentioned that and then...
Yeah, what's that?
What I mean by that is that the present can be very frustrating. I mean, put it this way. I think the libertarian movement has a real problem in the modern world, as it is right now, which is that it straddles both sides of the big cultural divide between globalists and nativists, between the people from somewhere and the people who want to pride themselves on being from everywhere. That, to me, is the big political story now. All the big dramas are that. We mentioned Trump, Brexit, and the French rioting.
Yeah.
They're all that drama. And we libertarians cannot pick a team and just back them to the end. We do not have that luxury if we want to be libertarians. If we join the Brexit people, we've got to accept that there's a whole gaggle of them who just want the fucking foreigners kept out and who don't give a toss about global free trade and who want to tax the rich into the floorboards. If we join the anti-Brexiteers, we've got a bunch of civil servants. The entire kind of official class of people who tell you can't eat sticky buns.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Indeed.
So what's a boy to do, you know? One answer is to run away from it, to just say, oh, to hell with it, I can't be doing with this, and go off and read about the Plantagenets or something. You know, that's what I've been doing for the last year. I haven't been writing much on Samizdata because what's the use? You know, I've got back into it, but for a long time I found myself, oh God, I just can't do this. And part of it was because I'm not on either. You know, count me out.
Mm.
That's my attitude towards these culture wars. I get both sides completely. I think I do. I certainly get the deplorables. I know what I entirely sympathise with them, but I think they have some very bad policy ideas. And I get the anti-deplorables, you know, the respectables or whatever you call them. But again, they have some horrible policies. And it is so much easier if you can pick a side. You know, in history, if you can just join one team and say, well, here's how we win. It's such fun.
Isn't that the sort of the problem about history? Often it's very difficult to join a side. I mean, yes, we as Englishmen can be go rah, rah, rah for Henry V, but was his claim worth it? Was his claim just? And frankly, I mean, seeing as, you know, England effectively lost the Hundred Years'
War. Yes, I long to see a spoof production of Henry V where Henry says to the Archbishop in the early scene, may I with just cause make this claim? And the Archbishop says, well, frankly, Your Majesty, no.
Yes.
I just think it'd be a laugh, you know. Because there's a whole... I mean, Shakespeare must have known what a rigmarole of nonsense it was. A whole lot of stuff about the Capetians and the female line and all this. He must have known this
you
was...
Think? Do you think? I mean, one of the things I mean, it fascinates you about history is the way that things that we regard as utterly trivial and unimportant now, we regard as terribly important then. I mean, religion being a...
That's true. Actually, you're right.
Example.
Yeah, yeah.
And...
yeah, I mean, one of the things I got from reading about the Plantagenets was that these were people who clung like...
OK, well, let's begin then. It is Tuesday, the 29th of January, 2019...
And we were cut off in mid-sentence, weren't we, the previous...
Yes, my SD card ran out of space, didn't warn me, and it's not the first
well,
time
you
I've
get,
done it.
You're getting what you're paying for, people. I've just been listening to what did get said on the machine, and I personally have just one thing to add, which was a deepening of that point about history as something you escape into from the contemporary world. And I talked about circumstances which were a disappointment to me, namely the fact that libertarians are straddled between both of the big political tribes in the world at the moment, the anywheres and the...
The globalists and the nativists.
Yes,
I think it was all the
yes,
way.
Or the somewheres and the...
Anywheres,
or whatever they've been called, which I think makes a great deal of sense. But I want to say more than that, which is that there's an even more galling thing to be escaping from, and that is when you are utterly bewildered, when you get things wrong. I didn't see the Brexit vote going the way it did. Once it had happened, once the team I voted for had won by 4 percentage points, I expected the Conservatives at least to unite around that verdict, and I got that wrong completely. I didn't think Parliament would be able to delay this very much, but it did, and it has.
That disturbs you, don't you? I mean, I find being spectacularly wrong fascinating.
I think you're probably a better man than me in that respect. I think central to my self-image is how tremendously clever I am. and being proved utterly confused wasn't an agreeable experience. That's it. But the point I wanted to generalise from is that I'm sure I may be the only person who made those particular mistakes about the Brexit process or whatever, but in general, it is the nature of old people to be confused by the world. If the world keeps changing, there are more and more aspects of it where they just say, I don't understand it, you know.
I mean, don't you find that... I'm a bit surprised. Maybe this just reflects the difference in our ages, but I think I have a better understanding of the world than I ever have.
Well, you probably
although
do.
I've made the same mistakes you have with the Brexit.
I think the point about you being younger than me is very true. I think I'm in my early 70s. I don't know what you are, so more like 50s, is it? I don't know.
Yes, it's 50s.
Well, when I was in my 50s, I knew it all.
Mm.
No, insult intended.
So, oh, I see. So it's all downhill from here.
It sort of is. Well, in the but I mean, there are lots of, there are more and more things where I just mentally say, oh, to hell with it. I'm just going to carry on doing what I do, and others are going to just do what they do.
In the sense that it's too complicated.
Yeah, or it's, yeah, it's too much to learn.
I mean, you're not a big fan of smartphones, are you?
No. But I should, I know that I'm being silly and old and ridiculous, because they're so useful.
Yeah.
It's clear that they are wonderful devices. But I'm, no, I just can't be doing with them.
There's an element of it that, the rewards you get if you're young and doing this sort of thing.
Are huge.
Are huge, yes. I mean,
50 years of, 50, of yeah. effectiveness. Yes,
yes, indeed. And also being able to keep up with your contemporaries. That's also an important part of it. And of course, yeah, as you get older, actually you'll it's we're going to do a
yeah, they start dying of natural causes. Yeah. That's when it's really scary.
Yes.
But what I wanted to say was that for all old people, some story of this kind is liable to play out. And I think that's one of the reasons why old people are so fond of history, because it is a world which has all the sort of trappings of sensibleness and properness and these things really happened and all that.
Yeah.
But actually, it's a wonderful alternative universe you can meander about in, safe in the knowledge that there's nothing you can do about it. You can't save anyone or rescue any cause. Or,
well, certainly when I go along to meetings of the Western Front Association, well, I'm often the youngest person there.
Yeah.
And maybe it just means that we'll be people my age, and as I get older, I'll find that I'm not quite so young anymore. But we will see. I mean, it may be something.
Well, that was the main thing I just wanted to add to that point, that it's not just some kind of particular circumstance which makes me slightly resentful of the world I happen to live in now. It is a deeper thing. There is an inexorable tendency of very elderly people to have to be told how to do things if they need to do them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the whole idea of a smart kitchen fills me with dread.
Yeah, me too.
And these
buttons you press and then it orders your parcel.
Yeah.
And what if a child gets loose on that?
Well, I heard recently a story about a parrot getting loose on it. He'd been ordering things from Alexa. And that, you see, that appeals to me because I'm an old geezer and I'm very suspicious about Alexa and all her works.
Yes.
And so the knowledge that a parrot has been creating havoc is pleasing to me. There you are. That'll show these youngsters, you know. That's what's going on there.
That's
why I like that story so much. Are there any other things you want to say about history? I'm sure I would have had other things, but that's my main thing I wanted to say.
Well, I have written here these words, the contemporary counterfactual, and I'm trying to work out what I meant there. And I guess it's that... I mean, counterfactual history, historians poo-poo it, and I'm not sure I'm in favour of the idea of thinking about what would have happened if, you know, for instance, the Germans had attempted to invade Britain in 1940. It's more a case of what people thought the counterfactual was at the time, which is incredibly important to understand.
But that very much was a counterfactual at the time, wasn't it? You've picked an example of something that was on everybody's mind at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you don't understand what Britain's was like in 1940 unless you get that.
Yes.
That was invasion was threatened, even if the people in high up places had pretty much satisfied themselves that it wasn't going to happen. They didn't exactly announce it in the summer of 1940, did they?
I guess not. Wasn't there some occasion when there was a certain night where they thought the invasion was going to take place and everyone was on alert? And quite a lot of people got killed.
I see.
Brits opening fire on Brits, in other words.
Friendly fire.
On people not having the right password.
Well,
and stuff
I don't know is the short answer. But I think that's part of the reason I've been wallowing in history more and more as my life has gone on.
Yeah.
I use the word wallowing to communicate the sense of self-indulgence that I'm getting at.
But do you, at the same time, I hope you do, you get something out of it. You learn something.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
yes.
Not just the facts, but it sort of gets your...
Yes. I mean, I learn history. What can I say? Yes, I like to think I do. But I'm sure that part of my motivation is as I've described it. And just recently, in the last few weeks, I've begun to get a handle on the Brexit process, which happens to be the big drama in politics at the moment in Britain right now.
Do you want to commit yourself now?
No, but I'm beginning to understand what's going on a bit better. I've been grasping hold of certain big things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was ranting on to you in the kitchen just now about how the basic problem the politicians have is that they don't agree with the voting public. The House of Commons is of a different view to the voters. That's what's causing all their difficulties. And I'm feeling more at home with understanding all that. And I've started reading All Out War by Tim Shipman, which is the book that TV show was based on. And I expect...
Which TV show is this?
Oh, the one about Brexit. The one with Cumberbatch starring in it.
Right. Oh. I thought it was based on... Was it Craig Oliver?
It's based on a lot of things. I mean, right, it's based on... Yeah, I think he's one... He's definitely one of the sources.
Mm.
But I've got a clearer sense. I've got less of a sense. I mean, I can remember when I did that posting about how, right, there it is, the Conservative Party will now unite around this verdict. Didn't happen. I just felt like an idiot.
Well, I agreed with you.
Yes.
Entirely. I thought this was the moment when the Conservative
Party... But it didn't bother you. Maybe it is that if you're 70, your reflexes are just slower in terms of forgetting what you thought before and developing a new opinion quickly. Or maybe you're just better at saying I was wrong. Maybe that's it.
Well, I don't mind being wrong on that, but it's interesting, certainly. Although I haven't really thought about it particularly deeply. You know, why are so many Conservatives so obsessed with remaining part of the European Union?
I think it's deep in there. Reason for being politicians in many cases. They believe in that sort of thing deeply. I think it's a common mistake in politics to think that just because your opponents have silly opinions which they seldom express, that they don't have opinions and they don't feel strongly about them. They're just in it for the money or the cars or the mistresses or something. I don't think that's true. I don't think it makes sense of a political career to describe it like that.
No?
Well, not really, because if you... Once you've been in politics for a few months, really trying to do it, you would soon know that it's a very poor way to feather your own nest. It's like entering a lottery to get rich.
Yes, there is that. I had rather thought that's because politicians like power.
Yes, but they don't have it until quite late on in their careers, if they're lucky.
That's true. But they can also get onto a sort of... committees and stuff like that, and
maybe
swat around the world and go on fact-finding tours and this sort of business.
Yeah, I suppose.
They get letters after their name.
But go back to this counterfactual thing. What did you have in mind about that?
Well, I think there's any extra I wanted to add. Actually, it's just the idea that at any time people are weighing up the options, and when they make a decision, it's because they think the other options are worse.
Mm.
A classic example being Britain going to war in 1914.
Yes, as we...
And people don't tend to mention that so much, so you have to sort of infer what they were thinking, but there it is.
Yeah, well, the question, what the hell were they thinking, is always a good one to ask when something goes catastrophically wrong.
And often you find, actually, the thinking was fairly good. It's not quite good enough.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I've always thought wars are very hard things to stop, but you can't stop them just by laying down your weapons, because that could encourage the opposition to charge at you, you know? Like the withdrawal of those ships from the Falklands, which we are told encouraged the Argentinians to take the islands. Mm. I don't know how true that is, but it makes sense that it might have happened like that, which just goes to show how easy it is to start a war and how hard it is not to in certain situations. But that's just another thing you like to learn about history, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose that is part of it, is you accumulate knowledge and you start with certain simple ways of looking at the world, and then you get more knowledge. Oh no, that's not the way it works, and then it goes. You're constantly altering your... Well, you ought to be altering your views according to how the facts come along and what you know.
Well, I go along with all that, certainly. Mm. It's like an addiction. It's like playing puzzle. I compared it to that earlier in this conversation, I think. The one we had last week.